I'll start. I was saying that since I had aligned myself with Prastha, wanting to become a neurosurgeon, even though my credits for taking on this residency were to be in general surgery, Kraskoff was in a position to use me as he saw fit, though giving me credit for my basic training in general surgery, so that I spent the next almost 2 years under Kraskoff's aegis, during which time I also did general surgery, so that we arranged it that I would assist in general surgery in the mornings, and in the afternoons I would assist Kraskoff in neurosurgery. So I actually got killed two birds with one stone. But his office was also a political office, and since I was so involved in the Jewish community and also on the committee for the Jewish Home for the Aged, it turned out to be a perfect marriage of efforts, and I continued, therefore, my work in the Jewish community, and with Kraskoff it made it even easier because he was now as the medical director of Montefiore Hospital, was also involved in the Jewish community. And we then started a new adventure, and that was quite an adventure. It was called, and it was in cooperation again with the Ladies Hospital Aid Society, and it was called the Montefiore Institute of Research. This became a major undertaking, and I must say there was no other hospital in Pittsburgh at that time that had anywhere near this attempt at research other than the university itself. So that it really put Montefiore ahead in a certain sense of providing the opportunity to do research, to accept grants from the government to do this kind of work, and aid in training young physicians who would be interested in trying out new ideas in our laboratory. Again, I was interested and participated with Kraskoff. Kraskoff was a great organizer in that sense. We had a consultant whose name was Warren McCullough, who was then a professor at MIT, was an unusual man who had written many books, had been a psychiatrist, a gynecologist, and finally a metaphysicist who might have been one of the most brilliant men I've ever seen or talked to, and I say might because I don't know, I didn't understand anything he said. And I want to make comment that this in a way is true. There's a certain class of people that talk and write books that for the average citizen is very hard to understand or make much out of, and one has to always ask the question when they say there's only 10 men in the country that can understand what he's talking about, whether it's a game that they're playing. And I always wondered that about Warren McCullough, but he was a famous man, full professor at MIT. And I had the opportunity of working actually with him in the sense that I did the research that he outlined. We had the research laboratory obtained its funding from Ladies Hospital Aid Society and from private donations. Lee Foster, who was head of L.B. Foster, was the lay head of the research effort, as was Oliver Kaufman. They helped raise research funds. Interestingly, none of us who did the research in the professional level ever were paid for that. You don't get paid for doing research. But, of course, the nurses and the aides, the assistants, the animals, the equipment all had to be paid for. We developed, really Kraskoff did this, and he should be given much credit. He developed what is known as a primate laboratory. That means monkey laboratory. That was a unique thing. Only the major universities had such an opportunity. And because the monkey is so far up on the developmental scale toward man, that the monkey is a very important animal for brain research. So this was, of course, what my major interests were, and I had a whole team of people that worked on monkeys. We had a monkey laboratory for story monkeys and for the special instruments for putting them to sleep and so forth. We did this in collaboration and again arranged through Koskov's interest in psychiatry and psychology. We did it through the University of Pittsburgh Department of Psychology. Bob Patton, who was the head of that, was the collaborator. So again, I had the exposure to Bob Patton and learned an awful lot about basic research techniques and also a lot about psychological testing techniques from this alliance. Though Koskov did this amazing thing of raising the general curiosity and intellectual level of young physicians who wanted to develop in medicine and providing Montefiore with a status slightly above that of others in the city, the politics, however, never settled down. And the politics consisted of stress not only among some of the doctors who might have been jealous of his position and authority, but between members of the board of directors who had their own little jealousies going on. And Ivy Wolf became ill, fell out of a favor as far as a leading member of the board, and Stanley Kahn then became the president. And I remember well the day that Koskov called me to tell me that that he had been ordered out of his office by Stanley Kahn, and he was told to be out the next day. Now that's from the horse's mouth. I was in on that. I know all about that. That's not. I had already left Montefiore. I was then a resident at the Neurological Institute of New York, which is part of Columbia, and I remember being called by Koskov and Koskov's wife, and we discussed that, and he wanted me to call Elmer Hamburg, who was my stepfather, and discuss the matter with him. Elmer was then vice president of the hospital. Now you realize that this information that I'm giving you was then top secret information, but it is clear and unadulterated history of the time.
Stanley
Kahn.
Is he the one who owned the Bigelow?
Kahn? No, that's a different thing. That was Kahn. Nat Kahn.
Nat Kahn, yeah. Okay. So it's still K-A-H-N, though.
K-A-H-N. I'm not sure. I think it was K-A-H-N.
The other one.
Yeah. The other one was K-A-N-N, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
Okay, excuse me.
Yeah. And, but it's interesting that, you see, we were concerned, we were interested, there's a certain naivete in doctors, and there's no better place was it expressed than in Montefiore Hospital in these various situations, which I am now describing and will continue to describe, than the fact that we were interested in what was best for the progress of the doctors, for obtaining interns and residents, for providing good medical care. What we weren't aware of was there was an internecine struggle for power in the Jewish community. For example, Allegheny General Hospital at that time was really, and I say this advisedly, was really a second or third rate hospital. But they had as their chairman of the Department of Laboratories a wonderful man who later became a very close friend by the name of Robert Grauer. Robert Grauer was a member of the Jewish community. He was a brilliant man. He was an Orthodox man. He had an excellent Yiddish and Jewish training. He spoke languages very well. And however, he was jealous, or there was the struggle that existed between Jewish power, whether it should be concentrated in one hospital or it should be open to other hospitals, even though those other hospitals hadn't opened to us. Harry Epstein was one of Bob Grauer's best friends. Harry Epstein was also on the board of Allegheny General Hospital. So that he sided with Bob Grauer in wanting to take away some of the power of Koskov from the question of why should a private Jewish hospital have all this money spent on research. So these are the kind of issues. And they were based mainly on little jealousies, power struggles. Not on any real facts of life. If the research department did nothing else but take young men like me and train them to think in a research or scientific sense, it was certainly worthwhile. If that was the only, and it was to that time, the only possible exposure that young Jewish physicians would have to this opportunity, not being welcomed at that time at places like Harvard and Yale and even the Presbyterian Hospital of University Hospital of Pittsburgh. For instance, when I came back here as a finished neurosurgeon, I could not get on the staff at Presbyterian Hospital. There was no question. I didn't even think of putting in my application. Simply was not being done at that time. So that we had to make the most of what we had available. Bob Grauer was the chairman of the Department of pathology and laboratories at Allegheny General Hospital, but that's a long story about why he was. Believe me when I say that he wasn't loved for that position. He was given that position by the Singers, who he had as private patients when he practiced as a private physician. In those days, you could do both. And this was in the days of the Depression. The Singers were one of the wealthiest families in this area, I believe from Swickley, and they gave large sums of money to Allegheny General Hospital for the purpose of establishing laboratories. And because of their affiliation and friendship with Bob Grauer, he got that job. Believe me, nobody loved him at Allegheny General Hospital. I obviously became part of Allegheny General Hospital, and all that'll come later in this analysis, but I knew how much hostility had been bred by making him head of that hospital. But there was nowhere else at that time where Jewish doctors were generally on an equal basis accepted, wanted for either advanced training, research, and or practice purposes. So it was very important that Montefiore did this thing, but it was short-lived, and it was short-lived precisely for these little comments that are these little minor kinds of arguments that existed within the Jewish community. So Koskov was out, and a new order of things was developing. This was in the late 50s. The new order really became the new young community, consisting of a group of young physicians, of young laymen, I'm sorry, not physicians, who had been active in the young adult division, the division that I really fostered. That was Lester Hamburg, Al Rogel, then also Saul Shapiro, the Halperins, and I say the Halperins because both Bernie and his wife were involved. I can't think of any others just offhand, but they were the nucleus. Bergman was out. I think that he retired honorably, but he had reached 65 years of age. I'm not sure of the exact dates, but Irv Goldberg, who was, up to that point, had been employed at Montefiore Hospital as an accountant, became the director, the administrative director of the hospital. And he was a young fellow, and I liked him And he's still alive today. I don't want to use the past tense. I liked him very much. Irv became very involved with this new group of young Turks, and they decided that there was going to be a new order in medicine, that no longer was the Jewish hospital going to be isolated from the rest of the community. And they had, I think, some basis for this stance. And that basis was very simple. Bernie Halpern's wife, Ethel, was doing a research paper, and I think getting an advanced degree from the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health. The head of that, and I can't remember his name at this moment, kept filling her with ideas about the fact that Montefiore Hospital should not be an independent hospital, that independent hospitals were doomed to demise unless they had university affiliation, and that, correction, unless they had developed training programs in the various subspecialties and internship programs, as I've already discussed, and it was not likely that they could do this without university affiliation.
What year was this?
Now, I'm talking about the late 50s, and I, as I say, I'm not sure exactly. I was in New York at the time training to be a neurosurgeon. Excuse me. But I remember returning to visit on, I think it was 59 or 60, and I remember having a meeting with my then stepbrother, Lester Hamburg, at his home. I was visiting my mother, it was his stepmother, and he had this group of doctors over, this group, I keep calling the doctor, this group of laymen over to the house, they told me, you stay out of this. This is for us. We're going to change Montefiore Hospital, and we're doing it for your good. We're going to make it a first-class hospital. We're going to be a university hospital, and you'll no longer be on the outside looking in. So they had honorable intentions. What they didn't have was any real knowledge or experience or understanding of some of the problems. I always said, you know, it's strange that people who sell television sets in those days of washing machines should, or insurance policies should be responsible for deciding how the health of the community is delivered to the public. But that's, in effect, the way it was. So with Ethel Halpern's admonition, this group decided that Montefiore Hospital, one way or another, was going to become part of the university. In order to do this, they had to give up autonomy. The university people, and particularly the University of Pittsburgh, in my experience, one of the worst universities to deal with in this sense, and certainly the School of Medicine, as a closed corporation concept, were not willing to give up much of anything without extracting their pound of flesh. And the demands were great. They had to give up their autonomy. The chairman of the departments were no longer truly chairman of departments of medicine. The chairman of the departments were those people who were then the chairman of departments at Presbyterian Hospital, and Montefiore had to accept the principle of the, as I mentioned this earlier, the full-time, fully paid non-practitioners as head of departments, as opposed to the clinicians as had been the practice up until then. The principle that interns and residents, if there's going to be a teaching program, interns and residents have to run the hospital and not the attending physicians, which was a theme which was totally anathema to the Jewish community, but nobody was asking, either the Jewish community or the Jewish doctors. The Jewish doctors rebelled, and this was what I call the first rebellion. This was an involved, long, hard, bitter struggle. It started with meetings of the Jewish physicians, and at that time, Montefiore Hospital, let me just bring you up to date on what Montefiore Hospital had in his hand. Montefiore Hospital had 200 physicians on the staff. That was an enormous staff for hospitals at that time. I don't think even to this day, and I'm very, very involved in another major hospital and medical school, and I can tell you, we don't have 200 active physicians on our staff at Allegheny General Hospital. We have 500 physicians, but not active. We probably don't have more than 75 or 100 active physicians. Montefiore had 200 active physicians and dentists on its staff at that time. Montefiore had at that time 9 board-certified cardiologists on its staff. Allegheny General, the future great Allegheny General cardiology hospital of this part of the country, had only 2 board-certified cardiologists on its staff. Now, I just point this out because it shows what a Jewish community has and didn't know how to use or deal with. For example, we had a full-time, fully credited research scientist neurosurgeon in the form of David Koskoff. Allegheny General had a part-time neurosurgeon who came once a week or something of that sort, who did an occasional case there. That happened to be a very nice neurosurgeon, and he was my predecessor and a very honorable man. But he covered 8 hospitals. Montefiore Hospital, as I pointed out, had this really first-class developmental primate laboratory involved with credible people who really knew what they were doing. Warren McCullough, Bob Patton of the University, full professor in psychology. Henry Golden, the full professor in psychiatry. David Koskoff, PhD in neurophysiology, and young, ambitious people like myself and Richard Wexler and many others, Stanford Isaacson, now deceased, Sidney Kaufman, now retired, many of us who really got our feet wet learning how to do research in this environment. Montefiore had this. No other private hospital in Pittsburgh had this to offer. None of us were welcome at the university. So that this was an opportunity for the Jewish community and Jewish physicians. Nonetheless, this status notwithstanding, there was this idea that you weren't going to get residents if you weren't university affiliated, and if you didn't get residents, you didn't amount to anything, and you had to have full-time physicians in charge of departments. And those full-time physicians did not necessarily, and probably were not likely to be, active practicing clinical physicians, but more or less were full or research people or people who sat and pushed pencils around rather than took care of patients. So that Montefiore Hospital then proceeded in this direction, which we then felt was the wrong direction, and we said so in many ways. The first way was to call a major meeting of all 200 physicians, and I think they were all there. There wasn't an auditorium big enough to house them. People were standing in the aisles. And my dear deceased stepbrother, Lester Hamburg, was then president of the board. And I remember him standing up on the platform in his inimitable and unpleasant way, and I knew this only too well, said to these 200 rather competent, well-recognized people of learning, if you don't like it here, you can leave. We'll get people to replace you. And therein started the major revolution in Jewish medicine. And with that, I said, started the downfall of Montefiore Hospital. I said it then, and I don't want to put myself out as a seer, but it was obvious to me. You cannot tear apart these kind of qualities without paying the price somewhere down the road. Montefiore Hospital did pay that price.
What year was that?
That was 1962. I'm estimating. It might have been 61, it might have been 63. I will say about 63. this precipitated an event which, by a small group of people, two of whom I know very well, namely the development of a private hospital called Central Medical Pavilion. Central Medical Pavilion was the idea in the heads of Dr. Stanley Rosenblum and Dr. Hal Zubrow. They got the cooperation of an ambitious young real estate developer by the name of Jimmy Cooper. Jimmy Cooper is now deceased. Stanley Rosenblum and Hal Zubrow are now deceased. Stanley Rosenblum and I remained friends until his death 2 weeks ago. I saw him on his deathbed.
What was the name of the hospital?
Central Medical Pavilion, CMP. They dreamed up this idea. They had one of their first meetings in this very living room where I'm talking. About 40 physicians showed up here at the meeting, and everybody was enthusiastic about the idea of building a hospital totally separate from the Montefiore Hospital and leaving Montefiore Hospital. They had many problems because the question of raising enough money, getting enough financing, selling your souls to the insurance companies in order to finance it. I don't even remember all the details, but there was great enthusiasm. It did happen. It did develop into a hospital. That hospital exists today. It is now part of an extension of St. Francis Hospital. They've had their ups and downs. I don't think anybody made any money on it. I think that what happened was it provided a place for a lot of Jewish doctors to practice medicine and surgery on a fairly sound basis, not an advanced basis, not a highly scientific basis, but again going back to simply a place to do primary things. Gallbladder operations, as I said, where Montefiore had been during the 30s. Appendix removed, emergency room care for an auto accident, that sort of thing. Let's stop for a moment. Where did I leave? Some of the Jewish physicians left Montefiore Hospital, practiced there. Some came and some went, but there were still some there, and my dear friend, dear departed friend, Stanley Rosenblum, had his office there until the day he died.
Where?
Central Medical Pavilion, and many other of the Jewish physicians. Continued to take patients there and work there. And this was a total loss to Montefiore Hospital as far as patient source, as far as talented physician source. I know that the orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Sam Granowitz, still practices there. Dr. Stanley Hirsch practiced there for years. I don't think he does anymore. He doesn't do surgery anymore. So that they had a significant number of competent, well-trained physicians that were taken away from Montefiore Hospital. Now let me just go on and say what happened. When Montefiore acquired full-time physicians, now I just want to point out that how did this happen? The Montefiore board agreed that in order to identify as a university hospital, they had to adhere to certain university principles. Number one, as I mentioned earlier, was that the heads of all departments had to be full-time, had to be paid by the university, and had to meet their approval. When I say their approval, I mean the board of the university, not just the board of Montefiore Hospital. In this process, the two major appointments were Philip Trohan, who was appointed as chairman of the Department of Medicine of Montefiore Hospital.
Trohan,
T-R-O-N, and Mark Ravitch, R-A-V-I-T-C-H, who was appointed as chairman of the department, or chief, as one we called him then, of general surgery. Surgery, period. We couldn't have picked two worse possibilities from the point of view of the average Jewish physician.
finish your thought, there's nothing.
The reason I say that is because Mark Ravitch was anything but Jewish. He had been thrown out of two previous Jewish hospitals because nobody could get along with him. That was Michael Reese of Chicago and Mount Sinai of New York. He was an impossible, conceited, inadequate person in my judgment, and I say that advisedly. I don't care who hears it. He had dirty fingernails. He couldn't operate his way out of a paper bag, but he had tremendous ego, and he had a way of knowing how to butter up the right people, mainly Gentile people. He had the temerity to tell major accomplished neurosurgeons like David Kostoff about the circulation of the brain. I remember